Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Yes, there is this horizontal thing called time, but I want to erect something vertical that says, stop here. Here is a monument in honor of this thing that has happened. You know, here's what Manhattan looked like in February 2024. That is important to me. I'm looking out of a window right now, and I wish I could look at it forever. Just like I wish I could look at everything I've ever seen forever. Do you know what I mean? And so fiction is a way to do that, to sort of double string your experience in such a way that it kind of stands as a monument to itself.
I'm Jordan Kistner, and you're listening to Thresholds, a series of free-ranging conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they made afterward. Today, I'm excited to be airing a conversation with Vincent Cunningham, a writer I've admired for a long time. Cunningham is a critic at The New Yorker, where he writes about theater, visual culture, politics, and maybe more broadly, what it means to be an American or what it means to describe something as American. He's written about the branding of Budweiser, Trump's mugshot, the American tendency towards both hyperbole and irony, and a great piece called What Makes an Essay American? I think one of the reasons I've always liked reading his work is the nuance and empathy and incisive curiosity with which he approaches everything from a photograph of a plastic Kmart bag to the Instagram account Humans of New York to the January 6th insurrection to the comedian Tracy Morgan and on and on. He has that thing that critics need, a trustworthy and specific way of looking at the world. But the occasion for today's conversation is Vincent's debut novel, Great Expectations. Before he was a writer, Cunningham was a staffer in the Obama administration. And before that, he worked in fundraising for the Obama campaign. That part of his life is the inspiration for Great Expectations. In the book, the protagonist, David Hammond, follows a trajectory similar to Cunningham's, falling somewhat accidentally into political campaigning and moving through the world of presidential politics as both a participant and an observer. He admires the candidate. And at the same time, he's aware of the moral compromise that undergirds every aspect of American politics and America. Vincent and I talked about his time in the Obama administration and the book that he made from it. And we also talk about the connection between narrative and criticism in his work, writing as an almost elegiac act of preserving the world, and lots more things. As always, you can find us online and check out the e-publication arm of this project at thisisthresholds.com. Here's Vincent Cunningham.
For the purposes, especially of this conversation, I should probably mention the point at which I, like the protagonist of Great Expectations, David Hammond, joined a campaign for the presidency. I, even before that moment, was really interested in how a nation, this big, various, non-uniform thing, especially one as large as America, is in various ways rendered in literature. And so the sort of part of me that was in the back of my mind as writer was really activated in a way that has lasted by this experience of citizenship and democracy and kind of viewing the country from a sort of perhaps a perch above, a sort of vista.
Yeah. I mean, so we learn in the book kind of how David Hammond gets into the campaign. But how did that happen in your life? How did you become a part of that?
In this way, we are similar. There are many ways in which we are, David and I, not so similar. But in this way, we are. I was working as a tutor for a young man and a sort of a middle school aged kid, I believe. And his parents, specifically his stepmother, was connected to Barack Obama, had helped to fundraise for him back when he had run for the state Senate and when he was running for senator and all those things back in Illinois, and was helping him identify young people to work as staffers on his campaign. So it was this experience, as you know, I've had this experience in many different ways in my life of sort of being swept into something, not by my own will, but by some, you know, exertions outside of myself.
Yeah. Was it, I mean, were you excited by it, or at the time had you had, I don't know, prior curiosities that might have made you jump at that, or did it just seem like the next thing to do?
Honestly, it was the next thing to do. It did excite me. I think many of us were excited about Obama, you know, starting at least back when he gave that convention speech in 2004 at the nominating convention of John Kerry. But I was never a particularly political person before that. It was pure happenstance. It was like a bolt out of the blue, you know. So it was exciting, but also disorienting, and also kind of, all right, I guess I will, you know. It wasn't the culmination of any plan.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
I mean, that must have seemed like, as it would for probably any layperson entering politics and campaigning at that level, like entering a whole new world. And the kind of the articulation of that world feels like a lot of the art of Great Expectations. What was that like? What did you notice with your kind of writer eye or writer brain as you were entering?
Well, the big thing, working as I did and as David Hammond does in the fundraising part of a campaign, which is a part that is totally obscured from the view of the general public. You might see a news item about, oh, this quarter of the year, this candidate raised this amount of money or whatever. Every once in a while, there's a campaign finance scandal that makes its way to the front pages. But usually the everyday of it, the candidate shows up at someone's nice apartment and sort of rakes in checks as a result of the exertions of these people that we call bundlers or campaign fundraisers. People don't really think about that. And so that was something that I, first of all, sort of read symbolically, you know, as a way that like many of the strong forces moving us as citizens, as inheritors of national identity are invisible to us. But also, you know, as someone who comes from a sort of working class environment, you know, meeting en masse very rich people for the first time and seeing their houses and how they managed their household affairs was something too. And I mean, and it is a sort of, that is a classic environment for the novel to happen in, you know, the sort of moments of class disorientation or upward mobility, upheaval in the sort of awareness of someone, usually having something to do with money, you know?
Yeah, yeah. In that way, it feels like a really, really classic Bildungsroman of like this protagonist entering this large, disorienting, not always benign world.
That's right, yeah. It's so interesting, even in a character who's not sort of, as you say, sort of striving or whatever to get into a certain position. Just the change of scenery causes all these sort of seismic movements that are kind of heard as faint rumbles at first, but really break through the surface in the end. And that's something that I'm really interested in, just as a function of how we live, but also especially about how life and mobility in America works.
Yeah. So I want to back us up and get maybe just even a little bit into the nitty gritty. What were you doing day to day for the fundraising side of the Obama
campaign?
Sure.
Yeah. There's so many different, you know, as a young sort of lowest rank staffer, you're doing things as simple and quotidian as keeping lists of potential volunteers and lists of potential, you know, doing like sort of first level internet searches for people who tend to give to politics or other causes that we might one day call and cultivate as donors, or keeping lists of people who have offered to be interns in the office. But the sort of highest level work of that kind of fundraising office, which I, you know, gradually was able to help do, is to identify people who are very politically engaged, who want to be, again, what they call bundlers or campaign fundraisers, who, you know, say, I have an apartment that can hold 100 or 150 people, and I'm going to be the primary person that invites people to my house for when, you know, someone like Barack Obama is going to show up to it. And everybody at that party is going to give, whatever, $2,000, and therefore I will yield for the campaign $300,000, whatever, you know. And so you are working with that person to build the event, to collect the checks, to think of other people that might be sort of brought into this growing web, this network of people, and also then working with the campaign itself to secure time for the candidate. You know, he'll be in New York for 2 days, therefore you can do whatever, 5 fundraising events and put together these chunks of cash in a event by event, as everything is in a campaign, because there's, you know, at the end of the day, there's only one candidate. Everything is such a matter of where the person can be and how they can allocate their time. And at the beginning of a campaign, you know, I joined the Obama campaign in March of 2007. So, you know, just a month after he had announced his candidacy for the presidency. At the beginning of the campaign, so much of it is this, you know, this is well before anybody's going to cast a vote, you know. So much of it is this this race for cash, which was, as you know, like, especially important back then, because Obama was running against someone who had almost the power of incumbency in Hillary Clinton. So it was like, this was really important to do.
And were you taking notes? I mean, was it that... I guess I'm curious how aware you were, how much you were holding that kind of double lens that writers sometimes do when they're in a situation where they're both in the situation and recording it for later use.
Yeah, I think I've never been much of a diarist, and I have never managed to do that. It's funny, I'm reading right now the Vanity Fair Diaries by Tina Brown.
Oh, yeah.
About her time as editor of Vanity Fair in the 80s. And it is a series of diaries. And several times amid those diaries, she says, sometimes I think I live my outer life, or, you know, my life of going out, my social life, only because eventually I want to turn these diaries into a book, you know. And this of course, has a history. Truman Capote, his unfinished novel, Answered Prayers, was just this, a transmutation of his social life in New York. So, you know, this record-keeping function, as you mentioned. But I've never been a great diarist. But what you mentioned, this double view, has always been just how I view things. It took me a long time to realize that that's what it is to be a writer. But that's just always, I've always been in situations and also kind of seeing them from some disembodied place above my head. So while I did not ever say to myself directly until maybe, you know, until well after I start, you know, well after this campaign ended, oh, I'd like to write a book about that. I realized that I had been kind of storing subconsciously observations. And even though this book takes a very different turn than anything that ever happened to me, there's a lot that happens in this book that did not happen to me. it happens sort of, it's standing on a ground of observation that did, yes, start in those years.
And I'm curious, when did you start thinking about this material as a possible novel?
Well, you know, around 2013 or 14, I always knew that I wanted to write a novel. Well before I started my career as a journalist and critic, ever before I ever stepped foot into The New Yorker, I knew that I wanted to write a novel. And I have always loved, again, this issue of books that deal with this issue of rapid class mobility causing disorientation, that sort of makes the character reassess and recontextualize the life that has been lived theretofore. You know, a lot of what David Hammond does is reflect and think back on his own life. It's as much a history of his emotions as it is a record of whatever, however many months. And I also love to write parties. So back in 2013 or 14, I started writing sort of a version of this book that would only happen at parties. You know, that was the conceit of the thing that I started to write. Yeah, and it ended up not working. You know, I had like 100 pages and only one of them seemed to be working. It was the character standing at a party looking at a painting and doing, you know, kind of processing through it, doing something that kind of is reminiscent of criticism, but also letting it push him back into kind of reveries and moments of personal autobiography and all these kinds of things. That page is in this book somewhere, but it was like, I started again around 2016 with just that page and built this book around that, realizing that that was the mode, that kind of observation, that sort of closeness to a kind of criticism that I wanted the book to proceed out of that impulse. So starting from then, 2016, till when I finished the first draft of it in 2021, there was a sort of sustained effort of 5 years.
Yeah, that you're touching on something I wanted to talk to you about, actually, which is the relationship between prose fiction and novel writing specifically and criticism as it's living in this book. You're a critic, of course, and so much of this book kind of operates in a critical mode. We see David looking at things, whether it's an artwork or a build, you know, the interior design of a room. There's so much of that kind of critic's gaze in the novel. And I was curious to hear more about how you navigated or even just thought about the line between the formal elements of novel writing or construction and the formal elements of criticism.
Yeah. Well, one way to say it is, if you've drawn a narrator who might or might not end up being a critic in his or her life later on, one way to achieve realism is to have him think like a critic. Another way to think about it, though, is, you know, that I wrote this book in almost perfect parallel with my career at The New Yorker. You know, like right when I was starting as a staff writer at The New Yorker, I had, again, re-embarked on this new version of this book. So these ways of working have been twinned in my mind, you know, one informing the other, one teaching me how to do the other. And so, and I've tried to achieve a holism in my, I mean, in my life, yes, but also in my writing life of like, well, how can everything be an aspect of a whole? And so if critical looking is a part of my ethos as a writer, then I want it to be in everything, you know, just as I want narrative to be a part of it, just as I want a certain emphasis on visual description to be part of it. You know, I want to be, on some level, I want even every paragraph of what I do to sound like something that I might do. And so there's always going to be a kind of wafting in between, I think, a kind of borrowing one thing from the other. And, you know, if I could build a body of work that you can feel the chainings between all the different things I do, that would make me happy.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm trying to formulate a question about the connection between criticism and narrative. I think you wrote something, or maybe you said something in an interview a while ago that I wrote down because I just thought it was beautiful. And you were writing about criticism. You said, writing is one of the ways that we encase these things that evanesce the moment they happen.
Yeah.
The things no longer exist. Reading criticism is one of the ways that we speak through history to one another and not just distant history. And one of the things that I was meditating on after reading that quote was the way that you're formulating criticism as a kind of narrative building around the things of our world, that part mm-hmm. of the critic's job is to tell the story of what is happening around the object of consideration. And I'm wondering if that feels true, like maybe I'm assuming that that's something you think and that's not actually true. So first I'm curious if that's true. And then I guess I'm curious to know maybe more technically, like how the interaction between criticism and storytelling felt sure. felt important in Great Expectations. Is that too vague?
No. That's all so rich. Well, first of all, yes, that is what I believe, that criticism is a way of stopping time, because time is, of course, how we experience music and movement, and the motion through our lives happens only in time. So of course it's this beautiful generosity, right? This gift from God knows where, but it has also got this punishing relentlessness that, like, the moment something happens, it disappears. And therefore you could just call it noticing, you could just call it description, but the function that we call criticism is to stop it and say, to stand athwart time, and assert. And I've talked about this a lot recently. I don't know why, but it's something that's come up for me a lot. But like, assert your love for experience. That says, like, I want to. Yes, there is this horizontal thing called time, but I want to erect something vertical that says, stop here. Here is a monument in honor of this thing that has happened. You know, the sort of funerary purpose of, like, the eulogy, right, or that kind of oratory, is to say, here was this person, here was this time, here was this performance. It's not just about works of art. It just so happens that this function is best and most easily practiced on works of art, but it's everything, right? And therefore, if you think about fiction as the criticism of everyday life, it makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah.
Here's what Manhattan looked like in February 2024. That is important to me. I'm looking out of a window right now, and I wish I could look at it forever. Just like I wish I could look at everything I've ever seen forever. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so fiction is a way to do that, to sort of double string your experience in such a way that it kind of stands as a monument to itself. And so every time I write, even a theater piece, yes, it's like me as a body sitting in a room looking at a thing, but implicitly, and sometimes explicitly, sometimes I do this. I will talk about what was happening on the way into the theater and on the way out. And the moment you do that, you notice that criticism is not just a performance based on another performance, but it is in continuity with life. The moment you do that, you have to think about fiction as a way of understanding that narrative. I was here, I went and I saw this thing, let me tell you about it, and then I went here, you know? So our function of noticing exists within the function of narrative, you know? And so fiction is, on some level, the greatest fiction of all fiction is to maybe separate those functions, to say, here's something that happened, and then here's something that was, and then here's something that happened, and here's something that just was. Do you know what I mean? Like separating motion from description and using different registers of writing to differentiate one from the other, when really this is one seamless garment. That is the way that I have thought about fiction and the way that it has related for me to my practice of criticism.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's interesting. I'm curious if you take notes day to day. You're saying you're not much of a diarist, but that question of how the writer makes a practice of preservation or uses their practice in the service of preservation of a world that they love or experience they love. How do you do that day to day or not day to day?
Well, it's sort of day to day. Like, I'm not a good diarist, but I am a note taker. So like maybe my diary will be the mini notebooks that I have filled with like notes about art, you know? Not only when I go to the theater and I have to write about it do I take notes, but if I go to MoMA, I'm still taking out my notebook and trying to sketch one of the paintings real quick or write about how I feel or loose intimations like that. Sometimes if I'm looking out a window, as I've mentioned, I'll just quickly try to describe to myself something, the thing about it that matters to me. But then, you know, I do rely on memory, and I have this, I think, probably occult and misguided belief that what I I might lose this, right, if I don't write anything down. But the things, therefore, that I do remember must have some special resonance to me. Those must be the important details. So I do some of that. And then I also, you know, I think this is like the most perhaps contemporary thing about me and probably many others is that I take a lot of pictures with my phone. Just because like visual description is so important to me. You know, I love to describe things I see, whether they're faces or landscapes or little items that when you take pictures of them come to look like still lives or whatever. I just love that. So sometimes I'll take a picture with my phone and as I'm sitting down to write one thing or another, I'll kind of go through the phone, the camera roll on my phone, trying to remember things that I maybe wanted to render as prose or whatever.
How did you do that with, I mean, were you a prolific cell phone picture taker in 2008? I was curious what part of that year felt important to render, because it was such a different moment in time, culturally, politically, aesthetically, than the one we're in now.
So it's interesting. David has a very narrow set of criteria for the things that he describes. You know, he likes to describe works of art. He likes to describe dress, especially business dress. You know, going to events where people are wearing something like business casual, the way the cut of people's suits and their the sort of press of their shirts, all that kind of thing. And that to me is something that is lodged in memory. You know, it's something that is so remembered to me. The other thing that I held on to is the other thing that I held on to was the looks of certain dwellings. You know how sometimes, and I don't know if this happens anymore because people talk on the phone less, but when I was a kid, I would talk on the phone with a friend whose house I had never been to. And I would imagine where they were so strongly, you know, so like determinately that I would inevitably be like, no matter how nice their house was, I would be disappointed when I got there because it wasn't what I had made in my memory. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, of course.
It's a thing that you do when you read a novel and you like, I'm reading.
Oh yeah.
It's down why there you, on, yeah.
Yeah, it's why half the time I can't bring myself to watch the movie version of a book that I love because it looks all wrong.
You're going to mess up the house that I made in my mind.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And so one thing I really enjoyed was allowing partly like, okay, my memory, my absolutely rock solid correct memory of some places with that that function of imagination and memory. Creating apartments that don't exist is one of my most fun games to play. This sitting room from a spread that I once saw in a magazine, plus this bedroom from a place that I've actually been, and this, you know what I mean? That is something that I've, and this one that's totally imagined or is a lasting memory from a dream. And so many of the fictionalized apartments in this book are just like you can make a composite character, I made lots of composite spaces in this book. And so relying partly on memory, but also letting imagination and even desire come into your construction of certain spaces.
Yeah. Was there a mood or a feeling or a flavor of 2008 that felt, or yeah, of that time in your life that felt like had to be there, whether it was compiled I'm even just thinking of like, was there the feeling of a fabric that, because there's actually so much, as you're saying, there's so much business wear in this yeah, book. Like, what was the thing that needed to be there tonally or aesthetically to you?
Well, that is, well, one thing, you know, just like if you want to talk about like zeitgeist, like there's lots of BlackBerry phones in this novel.
Yeah.
And that is definitely a relic of a certain moment. And but also it's so funny you mentioned, you know, we brought up business gear again, because that was also the time where even people as young, I don't know if you're around the same age as me, but like people who were in their 20s around this time used to go to the club in like business casual dress.
Yeah, totally.
It's like ridiculous. You look back at these pictures, people are in like vests and pearls and that just like checkered shirts. It was miserable, just terrible. This was part of it. And also just a kind of—
So much like sweating in poly blends.
Yeah, just why, you look hot, man. And that was the thing, you just look so hot. another thing was just this like the sort of, and maybe this is where it's most recognizable because popular music is so, to me, like downbeat now, or like it's like a sort of minor key crooning a lot of the time. And it was so major key back then. Like one of the songs that I remember hearing all the time back then was American Boy by Estelle.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
You'll be of course. American Boy
with Kanye. And then like there was a song by Will.i.am that just like, that was like a pro Obama. He did this song called Yes We Can.
Just
like a major key sappiness that was, I don't know what it felt like. I think maybe we knew it was corny in the moment. You know, this is like right when T-Pain is coming up, when T-Pain's amazing. I would never speak an ill word about T-Pain. But even the songs that were like, you know, every T-Pain song is about being like alone in a bar, falling in love with one form of service worker or another, like sad, but not sad. You know, he won't let it be sad.
Mm-hmm.
Bartender, I'm in love with this strip, whatever it is, he's just like projecting onto these poor strangers, you know. But the affect was always this kind of upbeat, I'm having a great time.
Right.
And I think that was totally consonant with what was happening in the politics of that moment, too.
Yeah, that feels so well caught to me in the novel, the way that campaign was riding an aesthetic that was either ascendant or desired to be ascendant, right? That there was kind of a mood that it was tapping into and generating and kind of drafting off of.
That's right, yeah.
And maybe a little cynically too, at least so David seems to think in the book.
Yeah, it's interesting as a young person, and I know that generations are largely whatever, I don't know what they are. They're on some level fictionalized or imposed from above or whatever. But there does come a moment in your youth, I guess it's usually in your 20s, at least it seems to me, when you look kind of horizontally and see your fellows. Do you know what I mean? You see your generational cohorts and you try to figure out what they're all about or what the mood is. There does come, I think, this moment of self-awareness. Like, what kind of people are we? There are many attempts happening in this book. One of them is certainly to describe a certain kind of millennial coming of age. And we were described to ourselves so early and so often that I think that we did that kind of looking a lot at each other. And so to see yourself described as a cohort and then to see yourself being marketed, if not pandered to, is a really interesting thing. I think it jolts you, or it at least jolts a certain kind of person into a mode of irony, you know, that says, what is it about me or my friends that makes you think that we respond to this or that? And wait a second, it's working all of a sudden. And what does that mean? So there's a kind of humor to that for me.
Yeah. Now you've led me to a question that I'm going to ask, and like maybe we'll cut it because I feel like it's a little bit, it's like a little bit of a nerdy question or an inside baseball question, but I feel like you've like brought me right to the door of it, which is I'm curious how much you think of this book as an entry into the canon of autofiction or not at all. Speaking of like millennial shit.
To the extent that Christian Lorentzen, who is a critic that I admire, has talked about, you know, the how hard it is to pin down exactly what people mean when they talk about autofiction. But one way to talk about it is as an extension of the tradition of the Künstlerroman, the narrative of artistic coming of age. Mm-hmm. And I can certainly see some of that in the essayistic passages in this book. The more, as we have been talking about, the critical passages in this book have a lot perhaps in common with books that have been at least classed like this, talking about the books of Rachel Cusk, Teja Cole, Ben Lerner, etc. Mm-hmm. But I have always thought that this has just, I think that this term has been just made broader and broader and broader to just mean stuff that has obvious correspondences to the life of the author, which is a much older and more pervasive tradition in fiction, you know? Like, one of my favorite novelists is Saul Bellow, and almost every one of his novels has some, you know, he's writing about his friend Delmore Schwartz or this other, or you can track those novels with his life, you know, when he's, you know, he was married to a Romanian mathematician, and so too is the main character of The Dean's December, which happens mostly in an apartment in Bucharest with a Romanian mathematician wife. Like, that is not a recent trend. And so I think that with the as I mentioned, the possible caveat of these critical passages, which I think it is a fair noticing that the preponderance of novels like that, whatever, in recent, I don't know, the last decade and a half or whatever, I think there is something to say about that. But more generally, I think the book fits into this much larger field of just novels that draw on experience and do so in ways that are perhaps trackable.
Yeah.
Not quite the roman à clef, because I cannot stress how many people in this novel really don't exist. Some of them may rhyme with people that I've met along the way, but others are inventions that are total, like composites and other thing like that. So I wouldn't call it a Romana clef either. But it certainly draws on the material of my life in the way that, you know, a symphony draws on a melody, right? Like, here's the melody, and then, but here it is in its relative minor key, and here it is stretched out or exaggerated, you know. That is the kind of more the metaphor I was of the for the way that I was working that I kind of see.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as I'm listening to you, I think that is also maybe how I read it, how it sounded to me. There's like a kind of, when I think about the books and authors that have come to define autofiction, which I mean, I think you make a really good point that that's like an ever widening term,
right.
Or the world that term is now deployed to describe is ever widening. But often in the ones that I think of as most strictly matching that term, there's a kind of it's not disingenuousness, but there's just this kind of constant winking around the question of narratorship and authorship within those books that I think that I don't read as present in Great Expectations. Now I'm just thinking aloud alongside you.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of a, I don't want to say edge, because it doesn't feel, edge doesn't feel quite right, but there's a quality to, there's a self-referential quality sometimes to the execution of a narrator in those. Well, that's not quite what I mean either. I don't know.
I mean, you're totally right. Often, so I mean, there are exceptions, but like, one thing that often happens in these books is that the character is named the same name as the person,
sure.
Which again is not just an autofiction thing. This has happened, whatever. We could talk about other places where this has happened. There is, I think that was really, well, this thing of like narrator, author, character as this like tripartite thing that, autofiction sometimes, as we have been given to understand it, tries to bring those things very close together, like vocal cords, right? Mm-hmm. You making a unitary sound out of a conceptual apparatus that really has three separate parts.
And that maybe draws our attention to that
right.
As a reader.
That's right. Whereas in Great Expectation, the narrator is David's older self.
Right.
You know, there are times when he mentions, like, I'm sitting at my desk right now and I still have this memento of this time. Establishing and acknowledging space between the telling and the living or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I reject a strict taxonomy here, or at least I chafe against it, because I view the novel as a kind of personal writing. No matter, there are too many words in a novel for it not to reveal something about the author. I just reject, you know what I mean? Like, I just reject any strict separation there. At one point, David is talking about the kinds of novels and writers that he likes. He's sitting in a room in Martha's Vineyard, and he's reading a book by the writer Dorothy West, and he's mentioning that, you know, there are spaces in a novel, just as in other kinds of writing, he's thinking about the New Testament as well, where you can feel the writer at her desk, he says, squirming stylishly to be seen. You know, that somewhere beneath all of the artifice, the narrator, the character, all of this, the author is there somewhere. And I believe that that is true of every novel. And it's part of the reason that I love the tradition of the novel. You know, into my mind just now popped L.F. Batuman's wonderful novel, The Idiot, which is a similar thing. You know, you can track the similarities between Celine, the narrator of those books, and L.F.'s Wikipedia page, but the true personality of that novel is not in those biographical facts. It is in the tone and the method of the prose and the way it sort of crosses spheres and the way you can see the character think and then live and then be. You know, that to me is the biography in the novel, not, plot points or whatever.
Thank you.
We're getting sort of close to our time, and I kind of want to just touch back to where we started, which was that moment in your, I guess, early 20s when your life kind of took this unexpected turn with joining the campaign. And I guess I'm curious. It's super clear the way that experience obviously informs the content of this book and of a lot of the themes in your nonfiction work. But I'm wondering how you think you might have been different as a writer, or maybe not a writer at all, if you hadn't begun that way.
You know, it's such a great question. And the approach at the end of this book is sort of a counterfactual approach. At the end of the book, the narrative, coming back to Chicago, where he lived as a child, and thinking about, you know, what if I had stayed here instead of moving back to New York with my parents? You know, what kind of person would I have been? Would I have started to write earlier? Would I have gone to a different kind of college? Because, you know, all these different kinds of things. So this is one of the ways that I think my life, you know? And the answer is, of course, unknowable. But I do think that I would have been looking still for ways to understand this country. I have been obsessed and just intrigued all my life with how writers think this country through. Whether it's about thinking it through culture, thinking it through history. I love Invisible Man, but I also love the critical work of Ralph Ellison. He's got a great book, definitely one of my favorite books. It's called Shadow and Act, which is an essay collection where, you know, he writes about all sorts of American themes, whether it's, you know, from Mark Twain to Duke Ellington, you know, just trying to understand what this place is. And for me, my introduction to trying to figure that out, again, was the forum that is the presidential campaign. But I hope and think that I would have been trying to find and obtain that experience by other means.
Thresholds is produced by Jordan Kistner and Drew Broussard. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshavood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Lorelei Grossman. Sign up for our newsletter, listen to past episodes, and get in touch at our website, thisisthresholds.com. Don't forget to rate and review our show at Apple Podcasts. It really helps. Thanks. We'll see you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.